And now move on to Lars Davis. Lars, you're a little bit sort of in the sandwich between two professors here, so you're in an enviable position. You might say you have a handle on reality, which others don't. I don't know. I'll leave it to you to make those remarks. But you're here very much as you're the commercial representative talking about corporate privacy. And Lars is the chief executive officer of Calypton. I hope I pronounced that correctly, Limited, which is an organisation that helps other organisations, other businesses meet their legal, regulatory and compliance requirements, including their privacy requirements. Lars, is in business now, but was a visiting fellow at the Institute for Computer and Communications Law at Queen Mary College, London, where he specialised in information technology law. It doesn't actually say this, but I assume you're a lawyer, aren't you, Lars, by training? Amongst other things, that's right. And you started off in the computer industry yourself. So man of many talents. Please go ahead and address us on corporate privacy.
My background is rather bizarre. I was a scientist, then I became a computer engineer, then I became a lawyer for my sins. Then I became, as you say, a businessman, or at least trying to be. The real thing is emptiness. That's the issue we face. Imagine a world where corporates have absolutely no access to personal information. What are you going to get? What are you going to buy? What do you take for granted now? Do you like buying your books and having recommendations emailed to you occasionally? Do you like being able to go and buy something, be recognized as being a loyal customer? Perhaps you get a discount. Perhaps you get an upgrade. Perhaps you like the fact that services are tailored for you. What happens if we stop companies actually getting hold of personal information or using it? Now let's look at what we've benefited from. And I say benefit, I must admit also that I am actually an ardent capitalist as well. I was an academic, but I'm still a capitalist. I like to think I'm an ethical capitalist. My mother was a missionary, so it's man meets man. It's sort of a nice balance. Occasionally schizophrenic. But at least you appreciate the nice things in life. Credit cards, for example. I can use my credit card anywhere in the world. I can buy things with it. But for it to actually be usable, my personal information has to be managed by corporates somewhere in the world. I can now buy books. I can get them emailed to me. I get suggestions occasionally, some which are useful, some most of which aren't, but it doesn't matter. At least there's something that I can benefit from. I can also work. I can get paid occasionally. When I was in the university, I could get paid. I got my payslip occasionally with some money and so forth. The university knew who I was. They knew where I lived. They had to. At least I could trust them to keep it reasonably safe. Sometimes it doesn't, sometimes it goes out. But at least there was a benefit. We enjoyed that. So there is a benefit to corporates actually having access to information. But it's not just the personal information itself. The thing which people sometimes miss is corporates actually have to look at a lot more information than simply personal data. And corporate privacy encompasses all of this. What about the actual core of knowledge? What makes you different to another corporation? How do you act? How do you sell? How do you comport yourself? How do you make your profit? Because profit is actually what keeps you alive. You might plow the excess profit into other works, you might plow it back or do what you want, but profit actually makes you work. Go back 5,000 years to ancient Mesopotamia and the advent of writing. Writing wasn't invented to record poems about love, romance. Writing was simply designed, invented, developed for trade transactions. The first bills of lading, the first bills of exchange, the first commercial documents you can find in the British Museum on clay tablets or clay stelae. That's writing. You can see records of names, individuals, what they bought, where they lived, how much they owed. But you can also see records of how organizations, even back then, operated. Why some succeeded, why some didn't. Again, keeping that information core to themselves was vital. They had to protect it. So that's an issue we also have to look at. We're not just looking at personal data per se. We're also looking at the information within an organization which allows it to differentiate itself from another party. And that's quite important. You don't want your knowledge base disappearing. That's why everyone signs NDAs these days. That's why you now have gardening leave. You do not want people to take your information, not just about your own customers, but also about how you operate out of your confines. The other issue we have, and this also hit us when I was trying to teach law, sometimes we succeeded, was what on earth do you mean by privacy? It's a wonderful term we bandy about. We need our privacy. We must protect it. What do you mean by it? Now, sometimes we criticize our American cousins. We say, well, it's mad that you must be wanting to sell all this information. But over in the United States, privacy has a different connotation. The idea is that once you've given your information to a third party, that third party owns it. They can do with it what they wish because you've given it away. On the continent, it's more of control. If I want to keep control of it, even if I've given it to you, I still want to stop you doing things with it. Or perhaps even more, it's confidentiality. I don't want you to know what I'm doing. Where do we draw the line? Well, what is privacy? Does privacy actually pertain to my character? Does privacy mean that I'm trying to define who I am? Can I retract what I put out on the outside world and bring it back in? Can I redefine myself? Can I present a false image? Now, we have case law where parties have tried to present false images. Someone has discovered that image, in fact, is false. And the court has said, no, you can't prevent that revelation. The fact that you've been living a lie. Is that a breach of privacy? What do you mean by it? Is a corporate's attempt to actually try and keep your information secure privacy? Or is it really one of confidentiality? Are we blurring the terms? Again, it's an issue that we haven't yet decided. The other aspect which often comes to mind is people sometimes claim we own the data. Well, do you? Can you actually own information in law? You can control it. You might have certain rights to it, but do you actually own it? Do you own it the same way that you own your suit, that you own your tie, that you own your house, that you own your car, that you own your pen? Do property rights actually attach to information? Again, these terms are bandied about quite a lot in the press without actually trying to define what they mean or honing down on the actual meaning itself. But then, does it really matter? Does it really matter if we're trying to protect information, but who actually owns it? If, for example, we have information in government, both the way the departments work, which is central to the way they've developed that information, and also they've got our information, is it not in our interest that they protect both equally? Who cares who owns that information? Or do you, perhaps? I don't know. It's never been decided. So perhaps we need to look at the problem in a different way. Change our perspective slightly. Sometimes it works. Change things around. Then you get meaning, perhaps. It's an old trick that lawyers use. The first thing we need, and Theodore Vail, who built up AT&T, realized this early on, was we need effective regulation. Now, AT&T begged the US government, please regulate us. We have to be a monopoly if we're going to deliver universal service. You must regulate us, otherwise the public won't trust us. AT&T begged to set up a regulator. They paid for the regulator. They trained the regulator. They said, look, if we cross the line, hammer us. It's the only way the public will trust us. Regulation can actually work. Regulation allows the public to understand the fact that corporates out there who will have their information, will actually toe the line. But that regulation has to be effective. It's absolutely pointless saying we regulate, but we do not enforce. We'll be your partner. Regulation comes with enforcement. Without that enforcement, without that pain of enforcement, you don't have the incentive to toe the line. And this is what Theodore Vail understood very well back in 1907. You need that pain. Pain works. Pain is effective. Think back to your childhood when you'd poke your finger into an electric socket, as I used to do. You very quickly learn not to. Why? Not because your mother said, you mustn't do that. You know, we'd be very cross. You learnt it because you woke up the other side of the room with your hair up like that and thinking, bloody hell, that hurt. Fire, it's hot, it's fun. Children love playing with fire till they burn themselves. Their pain stops them from doing it again. Again, I wondered once why peas bounce in a pot, so I put my entire arm in the pot of peas to lift them out and left a bit of skin in there. Quite a lot, in fact. Did it twice, I didn't know the first time. Second time I certainly did. Pain works after a while. Sun Tzu knew that. How many the audience are Oriental scholars. How many have read the book, Art of War? How many have read the biography of Sun Tzu, which is very subtle? The Art of War is an extremely subtle book. It's not about alpha males and how to win, organizations being full of alpha males. By definition, that can't happen. There's one of them. That's why he's the alpha, or she's the alpha. The biography of Sun Tzu is very, very pertinent to this area because it talks about how you actually enforce, how you make sure people follow the line. In the biography, Sun Tzu was asked by the emperor of the Wu Empire, Hou Lu, to see if he could train his concubines in the art of war. He said, of course I can, sire. Got the 100 concubines, put them into two separate platoons, and appointed the two favorite concubines of the emperor to lead each platoon. And he said, can you turn left? Yes, of course I can. You know you're right. Of course, good. You know how to jump? Fine. He said, I'll give you an order. Turn to the left. They giggled. So he said, okay, fine. If you're giggling and didn't understand the order, it must be my fault. I apologize, he said. I'll give you the order again. He said, turn to the right. They giggled. He said, okay. If the first time you didn't understand, it was my fault. If you didn't understand the second time, it is the commander's fault. So he ordered the two concubines to be beheaded, at which point the emperor said, you mustn't do this, I'm going to lose my favorite concubines, I won't like my food and wine, lose their savior, can't do that at all. This is when this famous quote came out. Having once received His Majesty's commission to be a general of his forces, there are certain commands that I am unable to accept. And he had them beheaded. He then appointed two new concubines to the lead. He barked an order, turn to the left. They snapped to the left immediately. Turn to the right. They snapped to the right immediately. All afternoon, he trained them. He drilled them. They jumped. They crawled. They threw. They ran. They stopped. They turned. They lay down. At the end of the day, he turned to the emperor and said, sire, your troops are ready. They'll march through to the gates of hell. The point is not to behead someone. The point is to actually show what the rules are and enforce them. And it works on both sides, both the regulator and the regulated. And that's important. The second thing we have to look at is apostrophe T, the most dangerous word form or letter form in the English alphabet. Why? It transforms a lovely little phrase, can do, into can't do. Everyone's favourite. You'll often hear lawyers, and lawyers will come along and say, oh no, we need another case to determine the meaning. Rubbish. It's an easy, lazy excuse. We used to tell my students, certainly, it's postgraduate law now, if you say we need a case to define the meaning, you fail. In the big wide world, in the corporate world, we expect you to give us an answer. We expect you to say, yes, here is something we can do. There might be some ambiguity, and you might say we want to know where the constraints are, where the limits are, but we can certainly try and do it. We can find an answer. Engineers don't normally use that they can't do. They will try and find a solution. If lawyers, or if engineers rather, thought the way lawyers think today, we wouldn't be in this auditorium. We wouldn't have bridges. We wouldn't have railways. Engineers, as you know, are trained to find solutions. And they're damn good at it. Lawyers are trained to hold committees. Trust me, there's nothing they like more than to have another committee. We'll have a committee to have a committee to have a committee that might possibly decide on the efficacy of exploring that cave. They'll still be outside a cave. There's also another thing I used to tell people. If you get a lawyer who says, ooh, don't know how to do it, fire him. There are loads more lawyers. There are loads of them, hundreds of them. You will eventually find a lawyer who can think like an engineer. Problem, solution. It might be that. It might be in all sorts of roundabout way, but you will find a solution that has no place. Unless it's absolutely certain you can't do it. You can't give all the information out. But it's a very, very, very useful excuse for most people. It's very easy to say we can't do it. It's very hard to say, or ask the question, how can we do it? There's a lovely little principle in data protection law, which I often came and was presented, even in the commercial world, talking about adequate security to prevent data loss. Oh, we need a case to find out what adequate means, we're told. No, you don't. Revert it. Use an old trick the judges do. Take a statement and invert it into question. If the data was lost, was the security adequate? If it can be lost, is the security adequate? That's how judges decide. They don't sit there and wonder for hours and days and should we debate what the word means, where this what. They are pragmatic individuals. They want to have an answer. They will give you an answer. Okay? Commercial judges are pragmatic. The other aspect, the other trick to it, and this is what also succeeds, is privacy actually has value. If we take privacy being this generic good data management rule, i.e. you're keeping it, not divulging it, but keeping it safe. Perhaps we can settle on that as a meaning. It works. There's value to it, but you've got to find it. And it's not just monetary value, although there is monetary value. Keep it secure. Our secrets are safe. Megacorp down the street doesn't actually know how we make our money with fewer people, with less hours. And we're twice as good as them. We're not going to tell them. There's value. Our information systems are far more efficient. They're cheaper to run. There's value. I got my records going back 20 years, so I can access my historical records to look for trends. There's value. So you need to gain, within the corporate world, try and change how you view information. Change it from a problem into an opportunity. And that works. If you look at the actual effects of handling data correctly, keeping it safe, keeping it secure, the very pervasive nature of it all adds value throughout the entire organization. This helps dramatically. Suddenly you find your management costs go down. You're not firefighting all the time. You actually find efficiency. The costs of running your hardware drop. Again, it's been designed correctly for the systems in place. You're not keeping too much information. You're only keeping what you need. You make sure you design your systems so they run so you can secure them. Years and years and years ago, we were talking about having to secure endpoints before endpoint security became a buzzword in the industry. Why? Because it makes perfect common sense. What's your biggest fear when you've lost a laptop? It's not the cost of the laptop. It's the cost of the information on it. Will our competitors get hold of it? Will it get out there? It's not necessarily the fear of enforcement. In some jurisdictions, there's very little enforcement. Slap on the wrist and so forth. In others, you get hammered. That's important. You're now thinking, well, outside of the legal environment, what's the direct cost to the way we operate? There's one other very, very, very strong issue that we have to look at. And it's not just the monetary value, it's the reputational value. In one particular jurisdiction, the United States, there was a move after data protection directives came up to try to see should they actually try and enforce privacy law. Should there be a privacy law? And there's still a massive debate. There may well be one now in the near future, 10, 20 years down the road. But there was also a proposal to have what they called the safe harbor. Now, lots of companies didn't bother. They thought, why should we encumber ourselves with European-style law? If someone gives us data, we can use it, we can sell it. Hell, we're capitalists. But there are others, they're more thoughtful. They thought, well, if we brag about the fact that we save people's data, we brag about the fact we don't disclose it, we won't sell it, we won't abuse it, we will keep it secure, we'll put a mark on our website, we will sign up to safe harbor, and we will put ourselves in the line of fire if anything goes wrong, then maybe customers will come to us instead. And they did, in droves. Bragging about the way they protected their customers' data or the way they protected their own information actually led to them becoming much more profitable, despite the fact they operated in an environment where there wasn't sufficient pain in the regulatory comeback if they failed. There was no need to sign up to Safe Harbor if they didn't want to, initially. There is now. They signed up because they knew it would be a commercial benefit to themselves. And that's a rather interesting lesson. Can you actually make it benefit? Do you need, or do you wish to decide to operate in a way, despite the fact that the regulatory environment may or may not be tough? Now, there are some jurisdictions, for instance, where if you go to the board of directors and you say, personal data protection, corporate privacy, they all suddenly stand or sit upright. They take it very, very seriously. Why? If there's a single breach, what happens on the front page of the newspaper is their name we put up in light saying, these people have breached privacy. They're in breach of data protection law. That damages their reputation. And they will fight to keep their names off the newspaper. Not in the courts, they will never hope in hell. They'll fight by making sure the information is kept safe. In others, they don't care. Another example where information management and data protection was so precious to the organization, it turned into a very profitable organization, was a bank, an American bank. They wanted to offer a product on the continent in Germany. The only way they could do it is they processed the entire offering back in the US. The Germans said, you can't do this. You can't transfer the information to the US because you have no data protection over there. The Americans said, we want to, we need to, we have to do it. What do we have to do? After discussions, they agreed to do the following. They agreed to put themselves at the mercy and subject of the German law, even though the data was processed out in the States. They'd keep the data siloed. They'd carefully vet the individuals concerned. The data wouldn't go anywhere else in the organization. It was compartmentalized. They then said that the regulators could come and visit at any time unannounced, and if they saw a single infraction of the German law, state or federal, then the executives would immediately fly to Germany and place themselves before the courts and say, prosecutors. And because they'd signed a contract to do so, that was enforceable in the state in which this organization was based. They agreed to be subject to a third jurisdiction because protecting the information, if they could show they could do it, meant they could become more profitable. It was valuable to them. That was the value. And if we change our perspective, if we manage to get the environment such that organizations understand there is real value to keeping information safe, to keeping it secure, to making sure the interests of their customers, their employees, their clients, whoever it is safeguarded and met, then perhaps we're going down the road to actually make sure we understand or can at least have something on the notion of privacy. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Lars. Very timely reminders. It was about the commercial value of information and privacy. In a number of ways. If you start with a business which is, you know, socially responsible, takes its responsibilities seriously, privacy is part of that. For many of you, your business has gone. Not quite in the online world, but it was brought home to me very much at a seminar a bit like this, where we were talking about security. And it was someone from Nectarcard got up and he said, in Nectar, you know, we take security of the information seriously. Because if we don't, if we lose or misuse our customers' information, and they simply stop using their Nectar card, keep it in their pocket, cut it up with their scissors or whatever, our whole business is down the tubes, it's finished. This was a lesson, he was saying, as a lesson to the public sector to take this more seriously. The more it's at the heart of your business, the bigger the drivers are. But there are some interesting questions about how translatable that is into the sort of database state in the public sector area, which Ross was talking about. So again, something for us to come back to in the discussion.